this is the deal breaker for me. Because I'm going to be in the air, I'm going to be, you know, somewhere where I'm just like, oh, let me just quickly note something.
What is it like building as an immigrant in the US?
The US system has still not catered very well to the migrant. I couldn't get a house, not because I had no money, but because I had no history. And he said, you need to give me a letter from your employer. Now, I'm an entrepreneur. I am my employer. I had to write that I am my employer. You go through, of course, a lot of culture shocks. He was asking me, hey, what are you doing in the US? And I said, nothing yet. I'm still studying the market. And I'm like, you've been in the US for 2.5 years and you've not done anything? I mean, you're an entrepreneur. You know, you get into the market, you see things, you just start to build. And I said, how long did it take you to understand what the hell you were doing in the US? And it said, give or take, would take about 3 years. But on the business side, the US economy is times 10, you know, most economies or more in Africa. That's one. Number two is that the way the US economy is structured is a lot more, I say, detailed, deeper, that the things that you overlook in Africa, for example, are extremely laid out and very detailed. So for the migrant, the very first thing that the migrant is going through is, number one, even trying to settle down from a culture shock. The second thing is...
Welcome to Funds and Founders. This weekly show is tailored for Austin founders navigating the early stages of their entrepreneurial journey. I'm your host and fellow Austinite, Abhinav Sinha. If you're looking for the motivation and the insight needed to build a successful company, you're in the right place. Welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you.
Wanted to ask you and get your take on, what is it like building as an immigrant in the US? So you moved here a couple of years ago, new place, new city, new country. So what's that experience been like?
Let me respond to that with a small story. So I was sitting at the Delta Lounge. Is that in Dallas or Atlanta? I'm not sure. One of those. And, you know, I met a couple of Nigerians there who flew in for a bed day and we're heading back to Nigeria. I was also traveling to Nigeria. So we're talking, and one of them, who had known that I was a founder in Nigeria, an entrepreneur, was asking me, hey, what are you doing in the US? And I said, nothing yet. I'm still studying the market. And I'm like, you've been in the US for 2.5 years and you've not done anything? Like, really? And the person kept questioning and was very surprised. And I was like, hey, the US market is very complex. And I was like, what do you mean by that? I mean, you're an entrepreneur. You know, you get into the market, you see things, you just start to build. And I don't know, luckily for me or coincidentally, someone else kind of walked in who was a Nigerian, wasn't our friend, but we kind of knew him in the entrepreneurial space in Nigeria. So like, hey, how you doing? Oh, come over here. And while we were having the conversation, I asked him, for how long have you been in the US? And I said, give or take 12 years. And I said, how long did it take you to understand what the hell you were doing in the US? And I said, give or take, would take about 3 years. And I looked at my friend and I said, I've only spent 2.5 years, so give me 6 more months. Why am I saying this? As an entrepreneur, even any migrant that actually moves from an African country, you know, I'd say, because again, you know, that's where I moved from, to the US, one of the things that you discover is, number one, you go through, of course, a lot of culture shocks. One, everything, every portion of this is in its large, you know, it's double, right? But on the business side, the US economy is times 10, you know, most economies or more in Africa. That's one. Number two is that the way the US economy is structured is a lot more, should I say, detailed, deeper, that the things that you overlook in Africa, for example, are extremely laid out and very detailed. For example, when you look at the healthcare, right? The healthcare is very deep, too many parties. I won't say too many parties, but a lot of parties, you know, the way transaction moves, you know, how, you know, we don't understand what is called copay, you know, on the African side, you know. So all those things are, they make it very, very, very complex. So for the migrant, the very first thing that the migrant is going through is, number one, even trying to settle down, trying to settle down from a culture shock. The second thing is the US system has still not catered very well to the migrant. Now, you tell me whether you can put this on record, but I'm going to say it. When I came in, so I flew in, I stayed with my friend, but I needed to rent a house. I couldn't get a house, not because I had no money, but because I had no history.
Yeah.
Right.
Credit,
the landlord wouldn't give me.
Yeah, no credit history.
Yeah, no credit history. Right. I had a bank account in the US for, so I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 years before then. But really didn't matter, right? Because the card I was carrying, well, I never even had a credit card, right? I had a debit card, but it really didn't matter. Now, the landlord, I said, yeah, I can give you an apartment. The one I eventually got to, you know, say, hey, I passed the test. And he said, you need to give me a letter from your employer. Right. Now, I'm an entrepreneur. I am my employer in Nigeria. So I had to write that I am my employer. That's the first thing. Number two was that if you do price to parity, my salary in Nigeria is piecemeal. In the US, I can't put that on the letter, which meant that I had to bump up my salary. Needless to say, I had to come up with some shitty letter to give to the guy to be able to pay, I think, 3 or 4 months ahead and get that house. And then I got into the system. I was able to get a cashback credit card, you know, and that was how I started, started building credit. And let me put that also in perspective. I think that in the first couple of months, I think a month or thereabout, I never had a social, if I'm not mistaken. I never had a social. So even trying to get, you know, things like that, things that could be tied to social was very tough. When I wanted to buy a car, because I live in Texas, I had to buy a car. The first thing that I had to do was to pay in cash. I had to pay cash down for the car. And yeah, every other migrant has gone through, you know, that, you know, same problem.
100%.
Yeah. So this, you know, the summary is there's just quite a lot in terms of the migrant goes through, whether it's cultural, whether it's economical, from a business perspective, understanding the market takes about 3 years to understand the market. And it wasn't like I never tried a business, but needless to say, the business failed because there were just a lot of things that I never foresaw, and that happened.
I think people just underestimate the need for a social security, build credit. What's the need for credit? And the US economy runs on credit and a credit score, and you can't even get a phone line.
Absolutely.
If you don't have good credit.
Yeah.
And people don't build credit, and then everything's cash. And like, for example, in India, credit cards just started becoming a thing. They have this concept of a CIBIL score that's coming up. People don't really use it, but banks are now like calculating a score. It may become a thing down the line, but there's no importance because India is a saving economy. You don't really take credit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not a concept people even comprehend. Like, why would I take a loan from the bank?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I don't have the money, I don't spend it. Like, mm-hmm. It's just not a thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, over here, I use credit cards for the system, the points, and like the game, but I'm never spending money I don't have. But that aside, I think there's a lot of misconception of locals think, oh yeah, just start a business, set up a landing page, put a Stripe link behind it, and like you can do it. I'm like,
do it. No, you can't even, it's very tough for you to register a company.
Yeah.
The migrant is still an edge case, at least at the beginning, when you move to the US.
Yeah, yeah. And like, we haven't even gotten into the raising money part. Like that's a whole other issue.
Ah, I didn't talk about meeting people. Apart from, you know, meeting people within, say, a work environment, I asked myself, how do I meet people? Number one, I had to be able to understand what those people were saying, not because I didn't understand English or maybe because I wasn't smart. You know, really, I believe I'm really smart. Right. But sometimes, you know, you have to understand their lingua. You need to understand their slangs and the likes. And I asked myself, where is the best place where I can meet people that would come and go, and then use them as a test bed to get better at reading lips, hearing people from different places. And guess where I went to? The club. So every Friday, I would go to a club, you know, and my normal, natural self, I really do not club, but I'll go to a club, meet people, laugh and whatnot. I start to talk to them. Some of them couldn't hear me, you know, and you know, the loud music, I was trying to speak my Nigerian, you know, accent, they couldn't hear me and I couldn't hear them. But after a while, I discovered I got better, right? Now, you know, when they lip speak, I could understand what they were saying. Now I understood the lingua, I understand how to crack jokes with them and the likes. And that was how I gradually started meeting people in the spaces that I wanted to, you know, like in, at meetups, you know, at social gatherings and the likes. But at that time, I was a lot more comfortable understanding how does the American things, or how does someone that spent, I don't know, 3-4 years in America, you know, gets to think. And that was how I was able to ram through it.
It makes sense. So you moved to Austin. How do you build community here? Because as an entrepreneur, what's the first thing you do? Because if you're building in a new city, what's your go-to tactic? How do you build in Austin? Like, how do you do it? Because I think entrepreneurs don't like building in silos, and you want to be surrounded by people who are building. So what's your go-to for that?
So I would say different people have different, you know, ways, but let me talk about how I grew about mine. One is the very first thing I do, and I think I've done a couple of times now without even thinking about it, is when I get into a town, I start to host mini parties. I can be an introvert, but I can say, I'm an extroverted introvert, right? So what I do is set up mini parties, share it with the people that I know, tell them to share it with the people that they know. You don't need to RSVP, just walk in.
Makes sense.
Right. So what that means is people that I don't know would come.
Sure.
And it's a cheaper way for me, for people to meet me, than I going to meet people, right? It's a cheaper and it's a faster way. So I get to meet different people. Likely would be, you know, like a third degree or, you know, 2 degrees away from the people that I know, but that's fine, right? And then we start to have conversations. People want to thank you for inviting them to your house and whatnot, or what do you do? And then they begin to say what they also do. Now, on the back of that, I begin to compartmentalize people to say, hey, this guy is in tech. The strength of this guy is technology. The strength of, is engineering. The strength of this guy is products. You know, this person is good with raising funds. And that is how I then begin to, in quote, reach out to say, hey, you know, this is what I'm doing. You know, would you be able to jump on a 10-minute call? Let's have a conversation around these things. And again, because you've actually made friends with them by inviting them to your house, it's very, very easy to, you know, to then connect with them. And that's how I just built the initial network of friends. And then they invite you to their own house, and maybe to, you know, introduce you to their friends. And that's how it keeps going.
So when you're doing these initial parties, do you tend to stay within the Nigerian community? Do you sort of open it up to everyone, or how do you sort of build that initial network? And so the reason I ask is, so like there's a bunch of Indian entrepreneurs in Austin, so we have like a WhatsApp group. Mm-hmm. They are trying to expand, but I feel like they feel comfortable amongst themselves, mm-hmm, versus being like, hey, let's invite everyone to like the stuff they're hosting, right? So how do you think about that versus building amongst your community, or do you feel comfortable with everyone?
I think, to be honest, it starts first with your community. Yeah. I mean, most likely those are the people that you know more. The way you word it is to say, hey, bring anybody, bring everybody. Some might bring someone that is not an African. Say, hey, you know, maybe, let's say I'm having a conversation with you. Oh, I'm going to a Nigerian party. And, you know, you can come along. And I just drag you along. Yeah. And then you show up and they start introducing you. Yes, maybe a lot of the people there would be Nigerian, but you're one Indian that is not, you know, not Nigerian. Then after a while, you then discover that, okay, so another thing I do also is to try to, within my neighborhood, right, see the people that I could connect to, you know, Hispanics, Indians, Americans, and whatnot, and invite them over, or even take them, you know, take food to them. But I tend to invite them over And say, hey, have you ever tried Nigerian food before? If the answer is no, this is your opportunity. Come over. You can spend 5 minutes. And these guys come, right? Most people, if they are techie or maybe, you know, they have value to add. They come, and gradually when you come and then see that there is a white, Hispanic, you know, Indian and the likes, or Asian rather, in that party, by the time I'm hosting the next one, you're more amenable and comfortable to bring any of your friend that you had thought about before, but never, you know, never crossed your mind to bring them to that party. Yeah.
And so what I hear basically is you sort of bring the network to you. You sort of become that sort of central beam, right?
Absolutely.
And I recently, have you heard of AppSumo?
AppSumo, yeah.
Yeah, I recently read a LinkedIn post by him where he was talking about how when he first started, he didn't know anyone, so he would start hosting parties. And he ended up meeting people like Tim Ferriss and guys who are pretty big right now, but he would host parties and he ended up meeting all the big authors and creators right now by bringing the party to him, bringing the network to him by hosting it and being the central point of the network. So I like that as a piece of advice for people who are starting out and trying to build support or find support. What do you think the importance of community is for a founder or an entrepreneur?
I'll rephrase that question. What do you think is the importance of leverage?
Okay.
Community is leverage, and community can be cultural, can be professional, could be spiritual, you know, religion and the likes, right? Every one of this is a leverage. Man has never been, you know, man was never made to go alone, right? To be isolated, you know, to drive stuff alone. You need people,
100%.
Different skills, you know, to be able to make things work. So once you look at the situation of, you know, from the angle of how can I leverage the people that I know, whether they are my friends, my community, the importance is enormous. Think about it this way. Yes, I'm an introvert, extroverted introvert. I like to have that extroverted. Sometimes I don't want people around me. Well, think about it. If I'm in traffic one day, I'm like, oh, damn it. You know, I wish everybody just disappears so that I can just get to where I'm going.
Yeah.
Then what then happens? Yes, let's say something happens. Everybody disappears. I get on the road. And yeah, the road is free. You now have a full car park to yourself. You have the whole express. Now everything then becomes meaningless, right? Your car breaks down. Nobody can fix it. You can fix it. You run out of water. I mean, everybody at the water station is half. What does that mean? It means that your community is what gets you going.
Yeah.
You don't know. You think you get yourself going, but the moment you take out your community, then you realize that you are naked. So what's the importance of community? Community is that clothing, is that wrapper, is that layer, is that shield, is that charge, is that blood, is that life wire that keeps you going in an invisible fashion without you knowing it.
You mentioned a really good point, leverage, right? So how does someone build that leverage? Everyone talks about you should always give and provide and help without expecting anything in return. How does someone starting out in their journey, in their founder journey, who maybe doesn't have anything to offer, how should they build leverage? Because they may not have anything to offer. So how do they go build those networks, build those connections? What can they give in hopes of maybe getting later? Because everything you hear online is, hey, go help, go make that connection, go do this, go do that, and don't expect. I'm like, great. Maybe someone in my position, you're like, you can do that, but there's founders who just started who maybe don't have those resources, don't have the connections, don't have the experience. How do they build the leverage? How do they start out? Where do you start?
I think the misconception really is around the fact that everybody believes that the help or the value that you're adding has to be very significant, and it has to be the most significant, most prominent, you know, held to that person. Say, for example, let's say what I believe you need now is to finally, you want to be the most populous person in the US. And it could be that the way I'm thinking about it to help you is, how do I make you so popular? But that's not true. And that is why I'll step back and say, everybody has something to give. It's just a matter of asking yourself, what I have, in what way can it be valuable to the other person? So don't think about yourself first to the person, think about the person backwards to you. And let me give you a very good example. While we were still in school, I had this problem that you talked about, you know, in terms of helping, giving, and the likes, and I didn't know how to solve it. But I studied one of my very, very, very good friends. Coincidentally, I still spoke to him on my way down here, right? He's in New York. And I realized that the only thing he does to keep people, connection, value, and the likes, is essentially just sharing links. So he reads something, and maybe while reading, he's like, who's going to be interested in reading this? And he just says, hey, here's a link in case, you know, I think you'll find this interesting. And that thing is so valuable to people because, number one, you spend time while you're reading, you know, scouring the internet for good stuff. You find it, and then you help someone kind of distill, you know, I don't know whether in India, but in Africa, you know, in the morning, the chairman or the CEO of a company is sitting in his office, then his secretary comes with the pile of newspapers, and I've sat and circled the places that person should read to say, hey, this is important to us, how
what? Yeah.
What that person has done is essentially what that
curated.
Yeah, curated those list of links, you know, for that person. And because of that, it also creates that value of, this is how this person thinks. If this person shares this, this is how this person thinks. So where am I going to, right? Even if all you do is you are a tailor, for example, it could be, hey, I have some pieces of clothes that I'm not using. I can help you ship off something for your campaign. I could, you know, just something. There is something that you do to add value to humanity today. How do you take that thing and be a spotlight in the life of someone else? And I think the statement is not essentially don't expect something in return. Just expect that something would come back to you in return. It might not directly be from that person. It might be that person speaking to someone else, and then that other person then gives you something in quotes in return. But definitely, it's like a ping pong. You know, once you throw it, it's going to come back to you. You're definitely going to get something in return. So don't think about massive stuff. Just do your normal daily stuff. And trust me, you're adding value to other people.
For founders or entrepreneurs starting out today, I think we briefly touched on this in an offline manner.
Yes.
Do you think having a personal brand or an online presence is important? Or at least in where we are today?
Online presence is neither here nor there.
Okay.
As long as you can be reached, it could be a phone number, it could be an email, it could be an office address to the community you want to target. As long as you can be reached, that's fine.
So define personal brand then.
Okay, I would define personal brand by couching it this way. When people mention the name X, what comes to mind? That's your personal brand.
Got it.
When people mention the name Laker, what comes to mind? Is it entrepreneurship, efficiency, operational excellence? When people mention the word, you know, Y, is it strategy, financial, corporate finance? Said, is it fundraising? So when it comes to like, hey, I'm thinking about somebody that has to do this. Oh, I know someone, and that's the person. So all you have to, you know, if you understand that, and then start to put a lot more focus into ensuring that you guard that thought process in people's minds, That is essentially what personal brand is, simply.
Okay. So how do you build that if you're saying online presence is may or may not be important? How does someone build that brand value, personal brand value, without online presence? What are avenues for someone to build this if it's not with an online presence?
Online presence does not build your brand value. Online presence only compounds your brand value. Building your brand value isn't the doing.
Yeah.
Let's put it this way. 5 people know you for something, for making the best leather wallets, for example. Online presence plus, say, you know, some feedback plus from, you know, referral, then compounds the reach. It is not the end. It is the means to the end.
100%.
So what that means is you still have a strong brand value within the 5 people, or 5 plus X, which is a second degree of those 5 people. But online presence can then take that to 20 people, 50 people, 1,000 people, 1,000,000 people. And if you don't have a brand value, even if you have a deep online presence, that's why you see some people like get online and just talk and whatnot, and you can't essentially trust what you're saying. You can't lay claim to, I mean, some people still believe and then fall into that trap and lose money and whatnot, but they don't have that consistent, rich, deeply rooted brand value to their name.
Makes sense. So just if I'm interpreting what you're saying correctly, is build a brand value and is find out those 1, 2, 4, 5 things, whatever those things are that you want to be known for, that you're good at, and go do those things, implement those things, and excel at those things.
Absolutely.
Whether you talk about them online or showcase those are insignificant. It's go do the work, and it will be known that, hey, X has done this work. And to supercharge that, go showcase it, go talk about it, and write about it online to add momentum to the, hey, I can do XYZ things. But there's no need to build an online presence as long as you are good at those things and you can go do those things repeatedly and excel at those things repeatedly.
So there's consistency and leverage and compounding that happens when you have a brand value, and then you sprinkle online presence on it, right? Online presence would only compound what you already have.
Yep.
Let me give you an example. The next CEO, after the current CEO of Google, for example, is probably known. He already has some sort of a brand value within his community, his colleagues at Google. You know, C-level, the founders, they already know him. They're probably sensing his, you know, getting his opinion on many things now. We don't know him. We probably haven't seen him speak at a podcast before. At the point when they decide that, yeah, maybe, you know, we want this guy to be the CEO, then they start shipping him up. He starts to speak and the like.
Got it.
Right. So his brand value
exists
already.
Got it.
Right. Social media and the likes just compounds it and opens it up to people that don't have any connection.
It's like the current YouTube CEO, right?
Absolutely.
Whoever, exactly. Yeah, I don't know his name off the top of my head, but
yeah.
Makes sense. Cool, I like that. Yeah, I think those are the questions I had. One segment I like to do that I forgot to do in part one is ask my guests a question for the next guest. So the question for you from the last guest is, what is your mission? And when did you realize that this is your mission?
Let me tell the story to couch what my mission is. Between 2003, 2004, I was depressed. When I mean depressed, not like depressed, I'm about to die or whatnot. But I just was, things just stagnated. I was done with high school. I couldn't get into college in Nigeria. I went to a technical school. So I was done with college, with high school in 1999. So I went to a technical school. I did very well. Wanted to use the technical school to get into college, you know, like A-levels kind of stuff. And I still couldn't get in because at that time, cultism was very rife in Nigeria. And the schools I wanted to, for some reasons, they said, hey, if you're coming from this set of technical schools and you are a male, give or take, you'll be discounted heavily because you could be a cultist. You know, such a, you know, blanket assumption on people. But I couldn't get in, so I felt very down. And in my pain, I wrote something on a diary. Couldn't remember exactly when I wrote it, but I can still see the diary in my, like, literally now, and the page where I wrote it. And I continued with my life. And what I wrote in that diary was this: you are a pipe. You don't own the water. The water is not yours. The more water you push to the other side through the pipe, the more water you get. And in that process, you would always be wet. The moment you stop pushing, you don't get more water. So, but I remember you are a pipe. And the outcome was really was like, keep pushing. So pipe is a conduit of value. The water is the value. You could say money, you know, knowledge, whatever it is, right? Impact and the likes, you know, and that was it. I forgot about it. Eventually got into college, you know, balling, got into school, was very popular because I'd done some work, you know, I was traveling around the country. I was making a lot of money, even as a student. And then one day I was rearranging my wardrobe in school and I'd forgotten that I wrote something. And I was rearranging. And that small diary, really small diary, it was an address book, actually. Leather, brown leather, pads of golden, whatever, at the tip, fell to the floor. And I'm like, hey, look at this. And I opened it. And I saw it there again. And it resonated so strongly with me until today. That is my mission. We are a pipe. Keep it flowing. You hold down on it, you lose it. You keep it flowing, you continue to get wet. So I tell everybody around you, my knowledge, the knowledge I have is not mine. The companies I have is not mine. The money I have is not mine. That is why maybe today I care a lot more about my employees. When people say, hey, you're in the U.S., why do you have businesses in Nigeria? You could move everything to the U.S. Like, in Nigeria, as a son, I have close to like 100, 200 employees. I don't make so much. I could be making so much here in the U.S. But every morning,
The impact there is
to that, you know, person that works with me and the family, you know, that goes to school larger, and all, and there's a multiplier impact. And for me, that is that pipe, you know.
The exponential impact is probably larger than if you employed 100 people here.
In the U.S.
The impact probably won't be as large unless you're probably doing 1,000, 2,000 over here. Mm-hmm. So
Absolutely. Think about it, right? Think about the unemployment rate, right? Think about the fact that there's no safety net. If I shut down a company, the guy starts getting, you know, vouchers or the likes from the government, it's probably going to be okay in a way, right? I mean, not as good as it would be, love to be. In Nigeria, if I shut down a company, the guy, you know, the kid's going to be put out of school, the guy's not going to have a job, he's going to spend many months going without a job. And the way Africa runs is, Africa is extremely communal, which means whatever I pay the guy, he gives part of it to his parents, to his brother, to his sister, to his kids, you know, his children, his sister's kids, and the like. So I'm not just feeding his immediate family, or he's not just feeding his immediate, because there's a value exchange, you know, his immediate family is feeding, you know, like two, three, maybe two generations, you know, further. And for me, that is what I term, you know, impact in that sense. So that is my mission.
What's one question you have for whoever my next guest is? And I don't know who it could be. It could be an entrepreneur, it could be a business owner, it could be VC. whatever your question is.
So, something that's been driving me lately is a statement. The statement says, this light is not a rehearsal. Essentially what it means is, we're not, you know, doing a practice of the real life we're gonna lead. This is it. A lot of us, maybe inclusive of myself, I don't know, probably, right, are living our life as if we're rehearsing and putting things in place for the real life we're about to live. And the question to that person is, if you fully understand that this life is not a rehearsal, what should you be doing now for you to really live the life that you should be living if you knew that there were no other life after this life?
There's no second chance.
Yeah, there's no second chance. Let's leave religion aside and, you know, the other beliefs that we have.
I have one more question. This is just more your take on having worked with founders, being a founder. What do you think is one thing that founders or early stage founders get wrong or misinterpret in their journey?
Yeah, maybe a couple will come to mind. Let me talk about the idea first. One, why your idea matters. First-time founders, more often than not, go after ideas, number one, because either because it's shiny or because they just, it is their passion. So things like thinking about the market and all those things don't come into play. I think one other one that a lot of people don't think about is why the investor is investing in you and who the investor is to you. Some will think the investor is your friend. Some will think that the investor is investing in you because your idea is so nice, it's the best thing since sliced bread. I wish we could think about that a little bit more.
Most investors need to return their money in 5 to 7 years.
Yeah. They
need a moonshot. So if your idea isn't a moonshot, they're pushing you to get there.
Why are they betting on you? Are they betting on the idea or are they betting on you? If they're betting on you, what in you are they betting on? Are they betting on the fact that you're very good at fundraising? Are they betting on the fact that you stick to problems longer? Are they betting on you because you tackle very hard problems? Are they betting on you because you take, you know, outsized, you know, higher than, you know, bigger than, you know, goals that are bigger than you? You need to understand that. And once you do, never let go, because you still have a lot more people better than you in that light. Different investors have different, you know, thesis for investing,
right?
Understand what makes you think. And you realize that investors would always line up to bet on you.
Thanks for tuning into Funds and Founders. If you're a local Austin founder, a venture capitalist, or just someone who's building and in the middle of their journey, and would like to be featured on an upcoming episode, submit your guest pitch to abhinavsinha.podcast@gmail.com. If you have a founder-specific event you'd like to promote on the podcast, you can also reach out to me. If you want to continue to get support through your founder journey, hit the follow button, and I'll see you in the next episode.